listening to the Sportageous Podcast, where sport gets smarter.
Welcome to the Sportageous Podcast. We bring you insightful conversations with people from all across the sports industry, including athletes, sports health professionals, sports academics, coaches, and sports entrepreneurs. On today's episode, I'm chatting to Dr. Marcus Dunn. Welcome to the show, Doc.
Hi, Zeeshan. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. How about yourself?
Good, thanks. I think, as discussed earlier, everybody's kind of working under lockdown sort of conditions or coming out of lockdown conditions at the moment. So I'm definitely getting to the point where I need a new haircut. But otherwise, I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, absolutely. Just hoping that, you know, things only go on the up from here, but it's so diverse and unique across the world that, you know, no one really knows what to expect next.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, looking at the kind of the world media at the moment, there are lots of huge issues being brought to light. So it's a very difficult and challenging period at this point in time. But hopefully, you know, positive outcomes can come of all of these different things that we're seeing happening at the moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, Doc, I wanted to start off by just introducing you to our listeners with a brief sort of introduction. And then obviously we'll delve into the questions and the discussion that, you know, I'm really looking forward to. So for everyone listening, Dr. Marcus Dunn is a research fellow at the Center for Sports Engineering Research and a lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University. His research focuses on applied measurement techniques and systems for biomechanical and performance analysis in representative settings. He's also worked with the likes of FIFA, the ITF, and FIVB in developing and further improving human movement analysis. Marcus is also a director at the International Sports Engineering Association. To summarize, an academic with a range of experience in the public and private sectors of the sporting world, and I'm really excited to be talking to him today. Let me kick things off. Obviously, I've given you that introduction, Marcus, but giving you an opportunity to elaborate a little bit about your background and story, how you got involved in sports engineering, and particularly within academia.
Yeah, sure. I think where I first sort of started, we're going back to school, really. I enjoyed sports at school. I enjoyed the study of movement, so human movement and why movements between different people are different, and whether that's down to, you know, physique, anatomy, or whether it's down to how an individual chooses to solve, you know, a particular movement problem in team sports, that kind of thing, for example. So I've always been interested in that kind of aspect of sports, and I guess I studied that. So I initially did in the UK, we do GCSEs. So I studied for GCSE in sports studies, and then I went on to my sort of further A levels and continued that. And then I went to do my undergraduate degree at the University of Portsmouth, and I think it was then that I got a real taste for biomechanics. I think it was the first time that it had been introduced to me on a meaningful level. So, you know, actually having the, you know, the tools and the facilities to really understand human movements, and I then started to, I guess, specialize in biomechanics from that undergraduate degree level. And I was always interested in understanding sports performance and movement in the real setting. What I mean by that is that we do a lot of experiments in laboratories where we have a lot of expensive equipment. As a researcher, we're always fully aware that we impose limitations on the very movements we're trying to study by having all of that equipment around those performers. So I tried to take as much of my research outside of the lab as possible from my undergraduate degree. So I think my final year project specialized in the biomechanics of badminton. We looked at basically 3D motion capture, electromyography, angiography. So what I mean by that is studying the muscle patterns, activation patterns, as well as the movements. We took that out onto a badminton court to make it as realistic as possible. I then moved to Sheffield to continue with a master's degree in sport and exercise science. And again, I focused on biomechanics and was again able to use more advanced measurement technologies to be able to study those factors around badminton. The question there was, with what I was trying to understand, was for those of you that are familiar with badminton, you have a smash shot and a drop shot, and the drop shot is a faked smash with the view to basically your opponent should perceive that you're going to play a smash, so they would move deeper into the badminton court to receive that. But then at the last moment, you would actually change your movement pattern to perform a drop shot, which is obviously very close to the net, which would then potentially put your opponent in a much more defensive and off guard position. So I wanted to understand, well, what were the mechanics behind that? Were there any potential elements within movement that might be used as visual cues within coaching, for example? So that was really good. You know, again, I got to hand with some much more advanced measurement technologies. So 3D motion capture, the type of thing that you see in Lord of the Rings. You know, the motion capture systems that they use to film Gollum and things like that with the retroreflective markers. So they're really, really good for tracking body movements. You know, the markers, they can track to less than half a millimeter of accuracy now. So they're really, really good. We can accurately model body segments movements from those markers to try and understand what's going on. Beyond that, I worked for a little while as a technician, so a biomechanics research technician. And again, that really started to provide me with a base of understanding around different measurement technologies, and again, how we can apply those to sports settings. From there, I was then offered an opportunity to study for a PhD. The PhD was co-funded by the International Tennis Federation. They were interested in trying to understand aspects of tennis player performance. So they had a research question or a gap in their understanding around the shoe surface interaction. And so what I mean by that is, so there are, I suppose, when you're moving around, again, just trying to sort of elaborate for your listeners, when you're moving around, you've got what we'd call a static friction interface. Usually, if your foot doesn't move or slide on the surface, if it begins to slide, we're then talking about a dynamic shoe surface interaction. And within tennis, there is stepping, but there is also sliding, which we all know, we all watch tennis, is there are functional aspects of sliding. So there's research out there that demonstrates that actually, sliding into ground strokes, for example, improves response times, rather than trying to step and play a shot. Actually, kind of sliding actually improves the response time of playing strokes. So there's a functional element of sliding, but there's also a dysfunctional element of sliding. And what we mean by that is players slip and slide. And sometimes that might be because, for example, if you're playing on grass, on first player to come on in a morning session, for example, there might still be dew on the grass, perhaps. You slip and then you fall over and injure yourself. So the ITF wanted to be able to understand that and where the limits were between functional shoe surface interface and a dysfunctional shoe surface interface. So my PhD, the very, very long-winded explanation there, sorry, was very much about, well, where do we start? There was such limited information about that interface at that point in time. This was a few years ago in our mind. The point was, where do we start? How do we take any information that we can from match play, observing what happens in real life, and replicate that in a laboratory? So my work was around, how can we understand those movements? So my work developed a markerless video processing algorithm that tracked the tennis player around the tennis court, but also identified the feet and also foot contacts. So we could then work work out things like step length, step frequency, movement speed, etc. So we could then start to understand, you know, how a player accelerates around a tennis court, you know, how they slow down into playing a ground stroke, for example. So if a player were to slip and fall over, you could then work out the preceding step strategy that led to that slip and fall event, which might have resulted in an injury. So we can then start to take that information and we can use that to parameterize or inform a laboratory experiment, so we can then understand that shoe surface interaction in much more detail. So that was what my PhD was about. And really the key there for me was that actually it was, well, how do we take our measurement in the real world? How do we use technology to understand what is going on in elite match play tennis without interfering with that tennis whatsoever? Because otherwise then you might well influence the very thing that you're trying to measure. And I suppose from there, you know, that was my PhD. From there, you know, I've continued working at Sheffield Hallam University. As you said, I'm a research fellow at the Centre for Sports Engineering Research, but I also teach as well, and very much aligned around this sort of subject area of measurement in sport, you know, using different research tools, technologies to understand human movement, but also, you know, kind of weighing up the pros and cons of, you know, which is the best tool for the job. Can you adequately measure what you want to understand in the field? Do you need to bring it into the laboratory, etc., etc.?
Right. That's absolutely fascinating. And there's several things there that I could break down, but I was particularly interested in the point where you talked about how the research that obviously you've conducted over several years in academia can be applied to the real world. And, you know, you've obviously done that. You've also worked with FIFA, I believe on the VAR front, but also with goal line technology. So how does that, I guess, transition, but also the application of that research translate into the work that you did or you were doing with FIFA across these various avenues and spaces?
So, I mean, again, so picking up with FIFA there, and I think goal line technology that you mentioned, it was probably, I think, one of the first sort of projects that I started to work on post PhD. So I think when I got involved with that, so goal line technology was just starting to emerge, and so sort of late 2013, 2014, it was just starting to be you know, being used as an officiating tool in football, and there was a question from FIFA as to, you know, how do we test this? So we've got a few different providers. At that time, there was Hawkeye, which obviously, you know, they've got a wealth of experience in tennis at that point and other sports as well. There were new competitors emerging. So there was a competitor called Goal Control, who actually went on to provide the goal line technology systems for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. And there was a question, well, you know, first of all, if we think about the measurement technology that you have within a goal line technology system, it's actually a range of different cameras. So I think anywhere between sort of 9 to, I don't know, some of them got up to 15 cameras or something, I think. But they're all filming at a high speed. They're all doing image processing to identify a ball or what the system thinks is a ball, and then to determine when that ball passes into the goal mouth, so a 3D representation of where the goal is. So there's key things there. So each of those cameras will be performing image processing, be performed on each of those camera images. There's also a calibration step as well before you actually then get to where they think the ball is in the real world. Now, the problem is that each football stadium is different, and that's down to, you know, the way that it's built, designed, etc., etc. So what that implies is that each particular stadium has a different calibration setup and therefore potentially has a different sensitivity to whether it's saying, you know, the ball footballer's goal and gone into the goal or not. So it was out. I think I can't remember the name of the group now off the top of my head. There was a test standard that was released that basically stated, that the goal line technology systems need to be able to identify whether a ball crosses into the goal or not to within a tolerance of, I think it was plus or minus 15 millimeters. And so what we did, we essentially started to take that standard and apply it in the real world. And so for us, that was, well, first of all, well, how do we do that? How do we test the system to its full capabilities? So looking at, for example, slow moving balls, fast moving balls that are obscured by players, for example, etc. All of these different types of scenarios. How do we test that? And most of my role was around the kind of we would use a high speed camera. So we would use cameras that could film. We use them a lot for sports research, but they can be used for things like ballistics research. They're really high speed cameras. But these cameras would be filming at sort of 2,000 frames a second, and then we would have a high speed video of that event, and we would also then calibrate that video as well, so that we could then determine whether the ball, and most importantly the call, i.e. whether it's a goal or a no goal, coming from the provider, was the correct decision. And by and large, we've got to say, over the years, I don't do that anymore. So when I first started doing it, it was very much a process of going to all of the different stadiums and testing them. So I've been all over the place. Went to about seven of the 13, I think there were 13 stadiums in the 2014 World Cup. So I went to seven of those to test all of those. Been all across the English Premier League in the UK, Serie A in Italy, the Ligue 1 in France, all over the place testing these systems. But as you can imagine, with the evolution of technology, cameras that can film at that particular rate and most importantly at a resolution high enough, the price point obviously then starts to sort of tumble over recent years. So unfortunately, I became too expensive to do that job, which is a bit of a shame because I've got to go to some nice stadiums. But it's just the way that, the evolution of that work goes. We do that initial, okay, here's what we do to test these systems, and that whole process then becomes a much more efficient, cost-efficient process. And then eventually, you kind of have your other sort of competitors that come in and then start to provide that service. I don't do that anymore. But there's also been, other variations of that. So you mentioned FIVB. So we did a similar sort of testing for the line calling systems in volleyball. Again, similar kind of process where we're trying to film with a high-speed camera and accurately measure whether a ball is being called in or out, whether it bounces on a line. It was actually one of my favorite trips, actually. So we got sent out to Rio de Janeiro to film some of the not the beach volleyball itself, but some ball impacts on Copacabana. So it's the kind of thing, when you're sort of telling your friends, what are you doing next week? Because I'm going to do some filming for beach volleyball on Copacabana. Honestly, it's a legitimate project. a lot of people didn't believe that one, but it was a true story.
Right. And how about, I guess, adding to that, your work on the video assistant referee or VAR front, and how has the research translated into that application in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, so VAR, it's another piece of work that we've been involved with. VAR is quite a contentious topic. The reason it's contentious is because of how the technology the technology is being used to assess it. So we did some initial work with FIFA in Germany, in Sandhausen, and that was to look at in a static case. So for example, for they kind of set up a scenario where you'd have a player standing on a pitch, an attacker and a defender, how accurate were the projected offside lines? So obviously in the video feed that the viewers would watch at home, so how accurate were those lines that are projected into the TV image? And we would assess, you know, well, how far away it was from the defender and the attacker, whether it was parallel to the goal line as well. And by and large, I am fully aware that there are some absolute clangers out there where it's gone completely wrong. But by and large, you know, the providers that we assessed were did a good job of that. The key thing there that I mentioned, though, was that, you know, that's in a static case. And the controversy surrounds it is principally around, well, you know, is a player in one place or another, and that comes down fundamentally to the instant at which the player is deemed to have kicked the ball forwards up the pitch. And the problem that we have, and the reason why it's probably so contentious, is because they're using the broadcast cameras, which have got a frame rate of 50 hertz. So it's, you know, an image or 50 images every second, for example. Because they're using those images, there's a, you know, if a player's running at a good speed, you know, they'll travel quite a lot of distance in between one of those frames. And the problem with that is, because it's broadcast and it's those broadcast images that are showed to the audience, everybody can see when it's wrong. And it's fundamentally not the technology, the processing, it's just the frame rate of the cameras. So you know, that is evolving. You know, FIFA, they are addressing that. We've recently basically responded to a tender from FIFA to address that question, and so that's in progress, actually. So we will be looking at the three-dimensional position of a player body locations in a field setting, using high-speed cameras. So, you know, again, sampling at 2,000 frames per second. So the benefit there is, if you're filming at a faster rate, so for example, you know, if you've got a, I'm going to have to make up some figures off the top of my head here, but with a broadcast image, you know, you might have a player that could travel half a meter to a meter within, you know, two images within your broadcast video footage. That distance that the player can then travel in high-speed camera footage is down to centimeters, if not millimeters. And then the point there is that then becomes much more acceptable for people to understand. So that's what we'll be doing. We'll be looking at you know, these three-dimensional measurements using high-speed filming, and to really sort of understand what the limitations and what the context of these measurements that VAR are providing are. And again, for me personally, I think it's VAR is a good technology, but I think it needs to be how it is put across to the public, the viewing public. It needs to be, you know, explained that, of course, you know, it has limitations. You know, it can assess, you know, the accuracy of an offside call to within a tolerance of X number of centimetres. You know, it shouldn't be definitively offside or onside. There is always going to be a measurement error and a tolerance there. And it's, you know, we see that with the ITF and, you know, the line calling that we see in tennis, and it's accepted. Yet, you know, it's not 100% perfect, but it's good enough. And the key thing is it better than a referee? And chances are it is. And the reason it's going to be better is because, one, it's more repeatable. You know, it's an objective technology, so that call can be analyzed objectively and reported without subjective interference. So again, what I mean by that is, with the referee, I don't want to be careful, I don't want to sort of cast aspersions about referees here. They do a fantastic job.
Yep.
But it's that, you know, it's a human perception of where you think the ball is. And a classic example in tennis, for example, the ball and a serve call, for example, is traveling so fast that the human eye can't actually detect the instant in time that it would have contacted the tennis court. You can, from your own perception, you can work out a trajectory, and you would then, you know, estimate whether the ball clipped the service line, for example, but you wouldn't be able to actually pinpoint an exact you know, kind of imaging your own vision, if you see what I mean. The same thing is true, obviously, in football there. So from that point of view, you know, VAR is a good technology. But the problem is that it's about how many images that the system has to work with. So the more information, the better. And I think, you know, as technologies advance, you know, again, and this is with broadcast capabilities as well as sample camera frame rates in broadcast footage begin to increase as well. I think that will solve a lot of the issues. But part of it is also down to the public understanding of those systems that are in place. And I think more actually could be done to educate the viewing public about the technologies that are being used and how actually they're not a definitive answer. There is some tolerance, but it's an acceptable tolerance. And that's the key message that I think that should be gotten across.
Sure. So essentially, you're almost saying that there is this need or requirement for a social or cultural shift, because I'm thinking of it in the context of, as you brought up, you know, with tennis and them having a similar sort of technology for a while and VAR being still being pretty new. And then, you know, I'm looking back at the example of the DRS system in cricket and how initially it was portrayed or it was perceived to be a very negative sort of way to go about things. But eventually, perhaps through that educational piece or by bringing about that cultural change, people were better able to understand what the benefits of it are. So you're almost saying that from the technology side of it, yes, it does have some risks in terms of the accuracy, like a tad bit, but essentially you are going to get a fairly accurate answer, but you have to be mindful of the fact that it is that way, and rather it's the audience should be educated on that front.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm going to put my hands up here. I don't know what the answer is there. I don't know what the best way to do that is. But, you know, for me, it's always the classic example of, you know, everyone sees the Hawkeye line calls in tennis. I'm not casting aspersions to Hawkeye here. We see kind of the zoomed in image of the elliptical shadow of the tennis ball and court interaction to see whether it clips the line or not. And it kind of, you know, like I say, everybody's seen them where they kind of zoom into kind of a hair's width of, you know, whether the ball was in or out. And again, you know, it's the technology is accepted. It is an official, a match officiator. But the point is, you know, everybody in that stadium and everybody watching that TV program will be like, yeah, is that right? You know, we're talking about absolutely tiny differences here. And again, you know, I'll put my hands up. I don't know what the answer is, because ultimately, as an officiating technology, there needs to be a call in or out, you know, very definitive, you know, yes or no. And that public understanding is a slightly, you know, it's slightly different. But again, you know, I think giving that information to the public and letting them understand that, you know, it's a best estimate, it's a good estimate, I mean, it's an acceptable estimate. I think that might benefit the use of technology in sport.
Sure. I mean, you know, perhaps I'm a bit cynical, but I feel that, you know, if you're not going to blame the technology, you're going to blame the referee, as we have done since the existence of a referee. So we're always going to find a way to criticize something or the other, but perhaps that's the cynical side of me.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and I've had these discussions before, and, you know, sort of, you know, when some of the height of the VAR controversy, and I was, you know, still defending it, and I was thinking, well, actually, from the other side, from a fan engagement point of view, actually, what have you done? Well, actually, you've got everybody talking about a game or a particular instance in the game where ordinarily it might not have been such a big issue. And the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, sport is, you know, it's a really important activity and medium in people's lives that the people engage with, and you want those events to stir conversation and discussion and debate, because otherwise, you know, if there is no debate about the call or there is no debate about the outcome, you know, is there a risk that the sport starts to then become a little sterile and then less engaging? So there's also, you know, for me, there's kind of that, what is sort of sport side of that coin as well that we need to think about.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting point. I mean, with the competition and the competitive nature of sports, you're inevitably going to get that. So that's something that I'm going to actually think about when I take away from this conversation. But Marcus, I wanted to move on to another area of, you know, the work that you've been doing, particularly with the ISEA or the International Sports Engineering Association. What is your role there and what is the association?
Sure. So I'm one of the directors of the ISEA. So there are four of us. So I'm the treasurer. So I get to look after the funding and financial sides of the organization. Professor David James, who's a colleague of mine, he is the president of the organization now. We also have Dr. Kim Blair. So he's the special advisor to the ICA, and also Dr. John O'Shepherd. So he works for Ping Golf out in the States, and he is the secretary. We also have an executive committee that forms up the organisation. And really, what we try to do as an organisation, we try to support the education and research that goes on in sports engineering. We try to do that from an academic perspective, but also increasingly now from an industry perspective. So we're really trying to look at, you know, what our offer is for people that work in the industry, how we can, you know, be of use to them, etc. And really what we want to try and do is build engagement and understanding of what sports engineering is, and how we can better the discipline.
Sure. And if you could summarize it for the listeners, and I also want to know, as I'm personally not in that field myself and believe that I don't necessarily have much knowledge of it, what is sports engineering?
So for me, you know, we've always been a little bit hesitant of kind of having a strict definition. But for me, you know, sports engineering is many things. It's engineering applied to sports. So it could be around developing new pieces of equipment. So it could be around, design engineering, for example. So aerodynamics of a golf club, for example. Again, kind of the interaction with a golf ball, or maybe it's a tennis strings, for example. You know, effects of string tension, etc., etc. It could be around the biomechanics of players and their interaction with equipment or playing surfaces. It could also be around how we understand performance, injury risk. It's a range of different contexts in which actually what we're doing is applying engineering we're trying to understand the problems and trying to come up with an outcome to either improve performance or reduce injury risk around sport, or also actually improve participation. But is it, engineering is very much around focusing engineering principles around a task in hand. So that'd be anything. There's a few different examples which I gave, which there are many, many more, and lots of different people, members of the ICA, that work in many different aspects of sports engineering.
Right. So a myriad of different things, essentially often applying engineering skills and techniques to various aspects of sport. That's sort of, am I right in perhaps summarizing that with my minimal knowledge?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I appreciate it. I probably didn't do the perfect job of summarizing it there, but effectively, yeah, it's the application of engineering to sports, to change something about a sport, to understand something about a sport, whether that's, again, the equipment that's being used, the performers or athletes playing in that sport, or how those athletes learn. It could be, again, it's the application of engineering principles to any different sport. So, football, tennis, cycling, running, swimming, golf, et cetera, et cetera. All sorts of different applications.
Sure. And my next question has a little bit to do with something that we focus on at Sportageous very heavily, which is the role of women in sport. And in the context of our discussion, when someone generally thinks of engineering, there's this sort of cliche, and it's well, to a very significant extent, it's well-founded and comes from a very solid background or research, whatever so it may be, that women are significantly underrepresented in the space of engineering. Is this the case with sports engineering too? And what do you think, I guess, needs to be done about this?
I think it's probably fair to say that that's true. We do as an organisation, we are aware that if I was to look at our member list, for example, I would see predominantly males on that membership list. That's not to say that we don't have female members and influences within our organisation. We so our previous president of our organisation before the current president was. Dr. Heather Driscoll. So she was actually again another of my colleagues previously. But she has done a lot of work in highlighting the role of women in engineering and science, and has actually done quite a lot around she's done TV articles, TV programs, and so on, and also been the president of the ISCA. So she's done a lot for supporting the women in sports engineering agenda. We also have representation from women on our executive committee as well. I'm right in saying Dr. Chloe Newton-Mann, so she recently finished her PhD at Manchester Metropolitan University. We do have representation, but I do also fully take on board that there is an underrepresentation, and some of the things that what are we doing about it? There's no one answer to that question. As you pointed out, it's a characteristic of all sorts of different engineering disciplines, subdisciplines, sciences, and so on. For me personally, is it strategies that we need to start implementing at school level? How do we start to introduce these types of disciplines of sports engineering, sports sciences, et cetera, how do we make those appealing to youngsters so that they're actually then able to, actively choose and pursue a career in these types of disciplines? It's a really difficult question to answer. One of the things that I can say, we do have funding opportunities. So members of the RCA can apply for funding. We have two funding pots. One is called the Engaging Sports Engineering Award, and that is usually for activities that cross-fertilize research or industry applications, or maybe it's like a research seminar, for example. It's a funding pot of up to £2,500. We also have an Engaging Students Award as well, which is for students. So that's up to £500, and that's to help facilitate students maybe go to a conference or maybe go and do some data collection at another institution or another place, et cetera, et cetera. Now that those two funding pots, they are, any of our members can apply for funding from those pots. We have a strong and objective assessment rubric for those for awarding those funds. They are open. There is no restriction to gender, ethnicity, or whatever with those funds at all. So for me, we have those open pots available. If there are female aspiring sports engineers or within our organisation, there is funding mechanisms for you to help advance and develop, the next stages of your career. But as you mentioned before, Zushanda, I think much more fundamentally, it's for me personally, it's how do we get across, what is sports engineering, what is sports sciences, at a very much earlier level in a person's education to inspire them to follow that type of career. And it's colleagues of mine have done projects where, you know, sort of school tours, for example. You know, I've been visited a few colleges and you know, given sort of careers talks and things like that for trying to introduce, you know, this particular area of work. But it's, you know, it's challenging. You know, we're a community of sports engineers, but we're, you know, there's not a massive amount of us. So it's how do we change that education curriculum, you know, on a kind of a national level. That's a very challenging thing to do. So like I said, I don't think there's any one answer. I don't think there's a simple answer. What I can do is point to the opportunities that we have available at the moment. And as I said before, they're open to everybody.
Right, right. Well, perhaps someone listening to this might have the skills or expertise to get in touch with you and perhaps work on, you know, developing that portfolio and enabling more women to participate and partake in sports engineering. I see the struggle in the media space, where I think, you know, the average mainstream media representation of women in sports is a meager 4%. And, you know, that isn't specific to any industry. It's a sort of, you know, worldwide issue. But look, thank you for those insights. I wanted to move on a little bit to another question, one that's a little important to me personally as well, which is that, you know, as a startup owner today with Sportageous, and as someone who used to be in academia, albeit very different space from which you are in myself, I have to ask, when I, you know, we at Sportageous, we speak to a lot of sports technology entrepreneurs. That includes, you know, organizations that focus on sports video analytics, broadcasting, whatever. So it may be even in the creative space of design and art and so on and so forth. Something that I come across is this perception that if I've become a, let's say, for example, sake in this context, a software engineer, I'm going to utilize that and become a startup owner because academia is not the way to go, or it's not the future, right? There's a lot of, personally, it's unfortunate that, you know, there is this perception with, I don't want to really go on a tangent here, but with things like self-development and that culture and perception that, you know, if you just stay on the grind, stay on the hustle, keep doing what you're doing. A lot of the sports startups that I come across, not all, but many, are involved in that space and don't necessarily like to engage with academia too much. What do you say to that sort of thing? And why do you think academia has a critical role to play in the development of products within sports that are viable in the market?
Sure. So I think there's a few points to that, and you know, what in terms of engaging academics, you know, sort of startup companies, it's challenging. The reason it's challenging is because, you know, I don't want to say it, but primarily because of cost. You know, for example, you could come to myself, for example, or, you know, other academics, and they would be very willing to work with anybody. Actually, I'd be probably fair to say, because that's the nature of what an academic is. You know, they want to be able to advance knowledge and understanding and applications of that knowledge and understanding. And so, you know, helping startups is something that aligns to that way of thinking. The issue then always becomes, maybe not always, about funding. And unfortunately, you know, within academia, it can be very expensive to engage with us. Now, there are ways of doing that. You know, there are funding calls, for example. You know, you could think about, you know, sort of larger national level grant funding, where, you know, if you had a specific, I don't know, product or something like that, and you needed assistance from academia to help develop that to a next sort of level, you know, so that you can then, you know, reach different markets or whatever it happens to be. There are funding opportunities available to, you know, startup companies or existing companies, and academics will want to work with you on those types of funding applications. There are, you know, I can also sort of think of at Sheffield Hallam University, we also have a regional funding application, funding process, where we can engage with companies for a period of time at no cost to that particular business. So we can work with them to identify, what would be a most useful application of our time and expertise to help develop their business. And we can engage with them for a period of time to help grow their business. So there are lots of different mechanisms to do this. They're not always totally clear because, there's so many different things about you always kind of have to read the, the small print, as it were. There's always, caveats. Some funding bodies will provide, all of your kind of associated costs. Some won't. Some will fund bits and et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you have to sort of, identify, be really strategic as in what you want to develop, have a clear plan of what that is, and engage the appropriate people. So again, from, sort of any sort of startups that you might be listening to, look for those academics that are in your space that you think might contribute to your company, and engage them. Send them an email, phone them, and they'll be, more often than not, they'll be very happy to speak to you, because it's interesting, and that's what academics do. They like doing different things, different challenging things that interest them. And if there's a way to do that, and this, external funding, etc., provides that mechanism, and if they can do that, they'll by and large will agree and help you develop your company. So there are ways to doing that. I've kind of forgotten your second point of your question as well, which was, do you want to just remind me on that? I've forgotten that.
I think that was more or less what I was sort of trying to get out of you in that question. I think that summarizes and explains, answers that question pretty well. Yeah. I also think that this is a great segue into my next question, which, when you were talking about the private sector or startups working with academics on that. So academics working with startups at that grassroots level, obviously at a much sort of higher level, you have recently, if I'm not mistaken, the ISEA and FIFA have launched a, correct me if I'm wrong, football research publication called the Topical Collection on Football Research. Is that, am I right in saying that?
Yeah. So basically it's what we call a topical collection, which is, it's a collection on a topic, the topic being football research. It's actually a collection that's housed in the Sports Engineering Journal, which is actually the official output of the ISEA. So basically what that is, it's a collection of papers that we've opened that. The purpose of it is to encourage authors, whether you're in academia or in industry, to submit your papers to the collection. So I'm leading. I'm sort of the lead guest editor for that collection, and we're working in collaboration with FIFA on that. And the purpose of that is to so FIFA, they've sort of over recent years they've obviously been sort of refocusing and restructuring a little, and they want to be open and transparent about the types of technologies that are used in football, and they want to see what people are doing in academia and across industry. And this is one way of doing that, but also being transparent in that process as well. So we can, we can have the results of the accuracy of some tracking system, published, so it's open, so everybody can see. And that's the purpose of that collection. So it's open now. So if you're, you're working in the area and you want to, you can submit a paper to that collection. So that's open now, and we will close it shortly before the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, with a view of driving media attention around the collection, and obviously the World Cup at the time. So again, if you're an academic, if you spend all of your time writing a paper, you want people to read it. So one of the things that we'll try and do is use that media engagement around the World Cup, and again with the help of FIFA and their media channels, promote that collection. And again, it's all about the kind of the nature of transparency, so that information gets out into the wider public domain. So that's really the purpose of that collection. So we've got a few kind of papers in review for that at the moment. So it's an open collection. Please, if you have a paper or paper idea, submit it, or get in touch if you'd like advice on whether it's suitable or not, etc., etc. So yeah, please get in touch.
Yeah, and look, we'll be happy to share that with our listeners as well. So probably if you head down when you're listening to this, you will be able to find the link to access the topical collection. So feel free to do that. And obviously, Marcus has provided a pretty detailed explanation of what it is and what they're aspiring to do. Marcus, I had one last question before we end the podcast. It's been really insightful. And I feel like I don't want this to sound as if I'm asking you to pitch sports engineering to me, but I genuinely want to know, as someone who's been in the space, why do you think that sports engineering, being, as broad as it can be, is a great space to get involved? And what I'm sure you come across youngsters or, undergraduate students who want to further come into this field and come to ask you for advice and the likes. What do you say to them about coming into this space in academia?
I think for me, and this is a personal thing, I've always, I think I've said this before, sport's always been an activity or a medium that affects so many people's lives, usually in a positive way. So whether that's, watching football, whether it's engaging with, maybe it's going park run, kind of, the public health questions, those types of things. It's, sport is something that lots of people across the world engage with, and in a positive way. And for me, I kind of have that interest, and I also have kind of the technology and the measurement and the understanding interest as well. And that's how I piece all of those together. And so for me, it's the engineering is around measurement and understanding. Somebody else, it might be, well, how do I develop the next golf club? How do I make myself or my athlete, pedal faster on their bike? It's all of these questions. It's how do I do this? How do I do that? And engineering is the way in which you would answer that question. So if you're interested in sports, and you're interested in kind of the mechanisms, the how does it do this, or and how does it do that, et cetera, et cetera. Sports engineering is a field to have a look at. Most people within sports engineering focus on very specific elements of it. So you might be somebody that focuses on fluid dynamics and look at aerodynamics of the peloton in the Tour de France or something like that, or you might be a mechanical engineer, again looking at developing new golf clubs, for example. You might be somebody like me who's doing all sorts of things, but trying to understand how people play sport in an actual sports settings, and what can we understand from that. But I think by and large, I think if I was to give somebody some advice, for me, it's, well, first of all, study a subject that interests you. Everybody will know what they're passionate about. So study a subject that allows you to pursue that. Also try and be open to opportunities that might help you develop your expertise. That might be some things that you doing within your degree, or it might be other things, other kind of bits of work that you're doing, and try and sort of be strategic in some kind of way, and have a plan as to what you want to do, and whether that's if you're at school and looking for the next steps to which A levels or whatever it should I go to take to be able to go to university, or what do I do after university. It's within sport. Sport industry and sport academia is a tough industry. It's not always obvious around what the opportunities are. Sometimes it cannot be too very sort of forthcoming with opportunities, but they are available. There are opportunities out there, and again, I think that's. There's something that you need to. The only way that you can take, the only way that you can identify an opportunity for you is to have developed your expertise and to have studied subjects that interest you. OK, Okay, so you won't perceive an opportunity as an opportunity unless you've done those things. So you know, you need to be able to put yourself in a position to exploit that opportunity if and when they do come along.
Well, you heard it here, everyone, from the expert himself. If you want to get in touch with Marcus, you can do so via email, or you can follow him on Twitter. We'll have the link up for you to get in touch with him. Marcus, thank you so much for coming on to the Sportageous podcast. It's been a very, very insightful discussion, and I feel like I have a lot to take away from this personally, and I would imagine that the listeners would as well. So thanks a lot.
Yes, I've no problem. Please get in touch. Very happy to speak to yourself again, Susan, or you know, your listeners that are interested in understanding more about sports engineering.
Fantastic. And for the listeners, if you're not aware, this conversation with Marcus caps off season one of the Sportageous podcast. As of next week, we will be starting a new video series, which you should check out, coming very shortly on YouTube and Facebook and the likes. Thank you very much for being a part of this journey with us in season one, and we look forward to coming back to you on this medium very shortly. Thanks, Marcus. That was great. Hope you enjoyed that as well.
Thank you for tuning into the Sportageous podcast. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.